Last Saturday, or I think it may be two Saturdays ago now, Travis Hunter won the Heisman Trophy for 2024, the college football season. Now, for some of you, that is a college football player, John, Zach, college football, American football player. And this award is given to the most valuable, most talented college football player in America each year. And he certainly deserved it, in my opinion. He played offense and defense, spectacular plays. He achieved much. But during one of the most important, probably the most important moment of his life where he is being recognized for his talent and accomplishments, he's accepting this award. And anyone who cares about college football was looking on. This young man who, to be honest with you, is very composed most of the time. He's extremely confident. He stopped and he looked into the camera and addressed his father, who wasn't there. And he said to his father, "Look at your oldest son. I did it for you. All the times you didn't get to see me. All the times not seeing my games, maybe only seeing two games in high school and now watching me only on TV, I am bringing this trophy home to you." Hunter's father has been in and out of prison, but for the most part, really didn't want to be at this award ceremony. When he was asked why he wasn't there, his father simply responded, "I don't want to go. I may be there when he's married or gets drafted, but I don't want to go. I will watch from home." Now, what's shocking about this man who's achieved so much, so talented, is being doted on by anyone who really matters in his life, in the sports world. He had his coach there, Coach Prime, Deion Sanders, his mom. Many mentors were standing behind him as he's accepting this award. The world is heaping praise upon him, but it seemed as if all he cared about was his dad. The absence of his father loomed large. He longed for the approval of his dad, and still, in light of everyone who is there who cared so much about him, said, "I did this for you, Dad." It's innate within us to long for the approval of our father, to long for the blessing of a father. And we've seen that throughout the book of Genesis, right? When God calls Abraham, the moon worshiper from Ur, and blesses him and promises, "I'm going to give you land, seed, and blessing." The question is, "But Abraham, who are you going to give that to? You don't have a son. Will Abraham, Father Abraham, be able to pass these blessings along to a son?" And then when he has a son, he almost kills him in an act of trust and sacrificing him before the Lord. And the question is, who will the promises be given to? It's a question even with Isaac and his sons. When Isaac is a father, and it's time for him to identify his sons, to bless his sons, the question is, for this man who is old and blind and can't see, is he actually going to bless the right one? He loves Esau, but Jacob is the one God has promised blessing to. Is he going to get this blessing right and identify the right son with the promise? Fathers passing along the promise to their sons. God identifying men who are going to pass along the blessing to their sons. There is this longing for a father to bless his son throughout the whole book. And even in the story of Jacob, it is a story about two sons at the end, Judah and Joseph. And the question for us is, which one is going to receive the blessing? And now there's 12 sons and 2 grandsons. Who is this father going to bless with the promises? With what God has promised him? And we've seen the tension. Joseph is separated from his father, but Joseph kind of becomes the golden child in Egypt. He deserves the blessing. But then we have Judah, and he certainly doesn't deserve the blessing. The 2 sons who will receive the blessing of the father. Well, as we move through this chapter, we see very clearly that the blessing focuses on one in particular. Notice verse 1 of chapter 49. Then Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather yourselves together, that I may tell you what shall happen to you in the days to come." And this is what we've seen throughout Genesis. The promises passed along to the son. But here there are 12 sons. And last week we talked about 2 grandsons. And Jacob realizes he's about to die. And he needs to tell them what God is going to do through them. He needs to tell them how the promises of God are going to work out among the 12 tribes that stand before him. Notice he says, "I'm going to tell you what will happen." This isn't just some sentimental moment where Jacob gathers his sons together and says, "We're in for better days, boys. I know we're in Egypt right now. I know we've had to move away from the land. It's all going to be better. God has told me so." Now, this is prophetic. This is a word of the Lord that will be true and real. And Israel will be reminded of these 12 tribes all the way through the Old Testament, even to Revelation. When we see the gates of heaven have the names of the 12 tribes of Israel on them. This is a prophecy. These things will happen. God has given Jacob a prophetic word for his sons. And I'm just going to summarize what he says to each one throughout. He begins with Reuben, verses 3 and 4. And he reminds him, "You are the firstborn, but because of immorality, you have lost that privilege." And Reuben plays a very minor role among the 12 tribes. Then we see Simeon and Levi. And remember, as they avenge their sister's injustice, they wipe out a whole people group and murder men and their animals. And because of this bloodthirsty violence that ultimately desecrated the sign of promise, they are punished. They fade into the background among the tribes of Israel. Levi will serve as priest, his descendants, but he will never have land. Zebulun, this will be a people who live around the sea and they're involved in commerce. Issachar, they're known as servants and scholars, his tribe, his people, his line. Dan, they are known as deliverers. We think of men like Samson. But the tribe of Dan, the legacy of Dan's people, often drifts into idolatry, and they're punished. Manasseh will eventually replace Dan's role among the 12 tribes. And then Gad, this people group that will have this great military spirit. All of this, Jacob is prophesying upon his sons. God has given him this word. And we see Asher and his people, they're known for agricultural wealth. Naphtali, they will live in fertile land around Galilee. And then we saw Joseph, and as you heard me read, you realize that Joseph gets the longest blessing, and it is laden, and it is thick with extravagant language describing what Joseph deserves. This is a man who's lived with integrity, a great leader who has provided for his whole family, and his tribe will be blessed abundantly. He even gets a double blessing through his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. This will be the most populated tribe. And then we see Benjamin, who will have military success. We think about King Saul, even the Apostle Paul is from the tribe of Benjamin. But it all comes down to one tribe when we see how this one tribe is blessed. None of these other blessings of these sons can even happen if this one blessing does not come true. If the tribe of Judah is not blessed in the way that Jacob declares here. Now, as we think about all of this, it's kind of odd. You have Israel, the children of Israel, who are they're living in Egypt because they've had to leave their homeland. They are a homeless group of shepherds with really nothing to their name. And even as we read all of that off, we're thinking, how in the world is that going to happen? That's just some sort of, you know, Jacob's getting to the end of his life and he wants to say something special to his kids. He wants to give them hope. So he comes up with these things. It's kind of like the guy that you went to high school with who always talked about he's going to play professional sports, he's going to make millions, he's going to do all these things, and he's still working at TSC. This doesn't make any sense. They are without a home. They have nothing to their name. And he is speaking these delusions of grandeur over them. And then he focuses on one, Judah, in verse 8. And notice he says, Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Now that's absolutely shocking when we think about Judah. Judah was the brother who led the other brothers to sell Joseph into slavery. And then he lied about it to his father. He dipped Joseph's coat in blood and told Jacob that animals had killed him. He went to live among pagans for a time. His first few sons were so wicked, God killed them. And we all remember Genesis 38, the most cringy chapter in the Bible, where we see Judah's legacy of wickedness that is laid before us. Why would this one receive such a prestigious blessing from Jacob? When we read of what will happen to Judah, we should be shocked of God's grace. Notice he says, your brothers shall praise you, and your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies, and your father's sons shall bow down before you. Why is this so significant? Because everything he is describing here is the description of a king. Among all of these brothers, you, Judah, you'll be a king. Your descendants will be royalty. Your sons and grandsons will be kings among Israel. Your brothers will praise you. They will bow down before you. And you will defeat your enemies. You will grab them and crush them with your strength. Now we see how this works out in the Old Testament. The tribe of Judah eventually is given the largest territory. They're placed at the front of the camp of Israel. But then we begin to see how this takes shape with King David. Remember, God promises King David that through him there will be a royal line that lasts forever. And in the story of David, it's not Saul, but it is David who is anointed by God. And we begin to see these glimmers of messianic hope through the tribe of Judah and the line of David. It is through Judah that God's king would come. That's why we open up our Bibles at Christmas and we begin to read the Christmas story in the Gospel of Matthew that is all about God's king. And we see from Abraham to Judah to even Tamar is mentioned. There's a peasant couple, Joseph and Mary. And you know who they descend from? David, in the line of Judah. And to them is born a king. This is why Matthew declares to us in chapter 2, verses 5 and 6, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. Of all the kings from Judah, all the way back to Judah, David, Solomon, all of the kings, the one that will come from you is no least of all the rulers. He will be the ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. We see Jesus, who is born of the tribe of Judah, is the king that Jacob is talking about here. He is the ruler that Jacob is prophesying over his son Judah. We see the king from Judah in Jesus. And we're to remember that at Christmas. As we think about the Christmas story, as we think about the incarnation, as we think about that night in Bethlehem, in the barn where baby Jesus is born, we're to think about the word that was given to Jacob all the way back in Genesis 49. And we're to remember at Christmas that God has done everything he would say he said he would do. This homeless shepherd in Egypt with nothing to his name said there will be a king who would come through his son Judah, and here he is in baby Jesus. And we are to remember that God does everything he says he will do. He always does. You see, we know and we relate to one another by what we say about ourselves and what we say we will do. That's how we know one another. When you meet someone, how do you know them? Only by what they say about themselves, and then what they say they will do. They prove to be trustworthy. They prove to be reliable. This is how we know and we relate to one another. And Christmas can be a time where you look around the room and you see a lot of people who've let you down over the years. There's a lot of people who aren't there. And you remember them in the pictures on the wall, how they've let you down. And yet you're gathered to celebrate one who will never let you down, who has signed his name on the line by taking on flesh and becoming a human, this one who is a king, this one who fulfills all of God's promises. As the baby squalls out in the barn, you are to remember the prophecy of Jacob and that God has done everything he said. He has brought about a king from the line of Judah. As you think about all the disappointments in your life, and this is a time of year where we do that. It's winter, it's cold. We begin to think about how the year's ending. We begin to think about next year. We begin to think about all the things that we haven't done. We begin to think about disappointments with others, with our company, and in ourselves. And we are to remember that God doesn't let us down. He does everything he says he will do. Meditate upon that this Christmas. As you think about this story, meditate. This is a declaration that God does everything he says. But notice next at verse 9, as we see this prophecy of Judah continues. Judah is a lion cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lion. And as a lioness, who dares rouse him? Here, Jacob describes Judah as a lion. When we think about among animals, the lion is the symbol of strength, the most regal, the most majestic, the most to be feared among the animal kingdom. Men and beasts fear the lion. And so, of all the other blessings, he looks at Judah and he says, you're going to be like a lion, not like Issachar, a strong donkey. You're going to be a lion. You're going to rise above your brothers. You're going to be feared. Notice the description. It begins as a lion cub, and then he becomes a killer lion, and then he is a lioness who is overlooking the prey. The picture here is of a lion up on a hill who has already gone down and devoured prey, and now he has gone to rest as his lion cubs, as her lion cubs, feast on the carcass of the defeated prey. Merry Christmas. This is a great Christmas sermon here. But it is a picture of one who has defeated his enemies, and the question is, don't mess with him. Who would dare rouse Judah? There is one who will come from Judah who will defeat all of his enemies and then rest. And you don't want to rouse him. And we see that this happens when Jesus takes on flesh. Earlier we were reading scripture together, and one of the verses in Hosea was about a lion who comes down to fight on Zion for his people. In Jesus, we have the lion that has come from heaven to fight for us. The lion who is God himself. And in the book of Hebrews, we read that when Jesus took on flesh and blood, he did so that through death, he might destroy the one who has the power of death. Why did Jesus take on flesh and become a baby? To fight. How did he fight? He died. And in dying, he destroyed the one who had the power of death, which is the devil. And why did he do it? To deliver us from the fear of death. You see, because of your sin, you deserve death. You deserve eternal death in hell. That's what you deserve for your sin. Your sin that is very real. Those acts of disobedience and rebellion against God, you deserve to be separated from him forever. You deserve to die physically and then be judged outside of his presence forever. This is what you deserve. And in this world, we live in this realm of fear because sin and death is real. Our sin, the sin of others. And this is a world where the Bible describes Satan has that power. He has a certain power because of our guilt. And he can use true things that we have done, real things we have done, to cause us to fear, to remind you of your past, to remind you who you are and what you've done. Satan has that power over you. But there is a lion who has taken on flesh to defeat him and to destroy that power. And how does he do it? He dies for your sin. He faces the punishment that you deserve, the condemnation and the guilt that you deserve, that Satan often reminds you of. You really did that, and you deserve to be judged for that. Jesus endures that, and he faces that penalty so you can be guilt-free, free of the fear of death. He's like a lion who has come down to fight. But we also see that he's a lion that has won the victory. And as we read in Revelation 5:5, the declaration throughout heaven right now for the believers here and in heaven is this: weep no more. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered. Right now, Jesus is that lion who is overlooking the prey that he has defeated. And his people have no reason to fear. Sin and death and Satan have been defeated. That's what the Lion of the tribe of Judah has done for you. You see, there was a precious yawn of an infant in a barn in Bethlehem as he rested on his mother's lap that caused hell to shudder, because hell knew this was no ordinary baby. This was a lion cub who would become a lion who would win and rule and reign. This is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. That's why at Christmas time, you've got to fight to look beyond the sweet baby Jesus pictures. You got to fight, because we get caught up there, because it's sentimental and it's precious. And Easter can't happen without Christmas. We should celebrate the incarnation. But as you do, remind yourself, Jesus isn't a baby anymore. He is a lion seated at the right hand of God. And that's good news for you, right? He has defeated all of your sin. He has conquered death for you. And so as you think this Christmas about your worst sin, about your worst mistakes, about the ways in which you have let people down, those seasons in life that you just can't get out of your soul. Where you did and you said things that haunt you day and night. Maybe it's sin even now that you feel trapped in and you can't get away from. I want you to see beyond the manger to the cross, but even beyond the cross to the throne of God where your lion is seated right now, who has defeated that sin, who has conquered those seasons in life that haunt you, that sin that enslaves you. There is a lion who has conquered it all for you. As some of us gather and we look around the room and we see it may be some people's last Christmas with us. It may be your last Christmas with them. See beyond the manger to the cross to resurrection, to the lion who is seated at the right hand of God. Your worst fear, your worst enemy, which is death, has been defeated through a cross and a resurrection. That's what Christmas is about. Christmas leads to Easter. Easter leads to an ascended Lord. An ascended Lord leads to a literal kingdom that he will usher in and he will rule and he will reign forever. And we as Christians can be like little lions who frolic around the defeated foe with great joy and security because the lion of the tribe of Judah has won and has defeated our enemies. But we see a picture of this kingdom in verse 10. Notice, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and he shall be, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. There's a picture here of an eternal kingdom. Notice, the scepter or the staff does not depart from Judah. We will see other kings in Israel, but it is a king from Judah who will rule forever. And we see it as a king from Judah that is promised to David, his line, that God told him, I will establish the throne of your or his kingdom forever. And here we see a picture of the nations, the peoples who come in and they surrender to this king and they bow down to him. And there is a picture here of peace and prosperity. You see, as we read our Old Testament, we see there's king after king after king that comes and dies. We see a glimpse of peace and prosperity in David, and then even in Solomon. But David and Solomon are dead. But we read in Revelation 1:18, there is one who declares, I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore. There's only one king who has died and who is back from the dead, and it is Jesus. In Revelation 11:15, we read that the kingdoms of the world have become the kingdoms of our Lord in Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. There's no other king in the Bible who is given the eternal kingdom but Jesus. Why? Because he is eternal, and he is God's eternal king. And here, through Judah, will come God's eternal king. And notice what this leads to in verse 11. His people, he will bind his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. The kingdom that this king will bring in will be so prosperous that his people will use vines in their vineyard as hitching posts for their animals. Where am I going to tie this goat? Where am I going to tie this donkey or horse? Well, I think I'll tie him to the vines in the vineyard. Because we have a lot of vineyards. And we are so prosperous. And notice the text continues. And he has washed his garments in wine and his vestures in the blood of grapes. Now, obviously, there is an allusion to Christ who dies and we are washed in his blood. And his garments are dipped in blood to secure our salvation. But the point here is that this kingdom is so prosperous, they use wine as detergent. And then we even see the physical appearance. His eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth are whiter than milk. Even physical appearance is marked by prosperity. And so there is a promise of great blessing. This king who will be born, who will come and conquer the enemies, and he will usher in peace and prosperity like you've never seen before. Even the people of Israel, they would look to Solomon and his ostentatious wealth and say, is this the kingdom? Well, Solomon dies and his kingdom moves away. No, all of this points to the kingdom of Christ, who will usher in a new creation. At the center is a city of solid gold and walls made of valuable jewels and rivers made of glass like crystal, and his people will prosper forever. Through Judah will come a king who will bring about peace and prosperity that will never, ever end. Now, first of all, why such description? Well, go back to the garden in Genesis 2, and we begin to see these elaborate descriptions of the garden. What all is there, and just almost gaudy provision for Adam. And then we go to the picture of heaven, and all of this elaborate description, solid gold and jewels and just the value and wealth of heaven. What is God doing there through these descriptions? What is he doing here when he describes this prosperous kingdom? There is a declaration that through this king, God gives us more than we ever need, and he will do it forever. God is the one who provides everything you need. And ultimately, he will do it through a king who will take care of the enemies of God and usher in peace and prosperity like you've never seen before. And you will enjoy it forever because of this king. You see, the reality, we not just read our Bibles, but human history. And we see that kings and emperors and dictators and parliaments and administrations, they come and go. And we look back and we say, what did they provide us in our history books? Seasons and times of prosperity. But in many ways, we're still longing for more, right? As good as it's ever been, we still long for more. And only in this king, in this kingdom, will we get everything that we need. It's the same reason at Christmas. It's never enough, is it? We get so hyped up for this season and this moment. I want to ask you, and you don't have to say it out loud, but what did you get last Christmas that was so significant to you? What did you give that was so significant to others? Maybe some of you came up with great answers. But for the most part, we're always longing for more. And it's never enough. The point of the Bible is the Lion of the tribe of Judah will give us everything we need. And we will never long for more. Why is that? Because in him we will have everything that we need. You know, there's a reason that we long for the blessing of a father. The Bible paints a picture that it is a father or the father that takes care of our needs. Jesus himself tells us that. It is your Father in heaven who will take care of you, and it is his good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Ultimately, we long for a Father's blessing because we know almost innately that only the Father in heaven is the one that can give us what we need. And what we need is way more than this homeless shepherd in Egypt could ever speak over his son. You see, from this point forward, history is full of unworthy fathers speaking and giving unworthy blessings to their sons. Without the Lion of the tribe of Judah, it's all meaningless. The blessings are hollow echoes of nothing until the lion roars in Bethlehem. But even more than that, until we finally hear the blessing of the one from heaven as his son comes from the waters of baptism and he declares to him, this is my son in whom I'm well pleased. That is the blessing that Judah points to here. The blessing of a father that is only given to one son. And as Jesus comes up out of the water and the Spirit of heaven rests upon him, we are seeing the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And it's not just a word of promise. It's not just a word of the kingdom. It is the kingdom itself, because in Jesus, the kingdom has taken on flesh. The promise of Jacob, the word is made flesh, and he lives a perfect life that you could never live. Obviously, Judah never lived. Obviously, David never lived. Solomon did not live. Only Jesus lives this perfect life. And so he is the only one worthy to die for our sins. God in Jesus is not just giving us a kingdom, he is giving us a king. And it is a king who in his blood, his garments that are washed with his blood on the cross that cover us, he is wiping away the shameful legacy of Judah, the shameful legacy of Jeremy, and he is replacing it with the legacy and word of Jesus. He gives us a kingdom, but not just a kingdom, a king in all of his righteousness. And finally, in this one, we have everything that we need. That's what Christmas is all about. In Jesus, you have absolutely everything you need from the Lion of Judah. You are forgiven, you are accepted, you've heard the word from God. In you, I am well pleased for those who are in Christ. So you are no longer looking around for someone who's not there.